This is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Welcome, everybody. It is Bob, Dave, and Moore here on 710 ESPN Seattle. The opening drive is brought to you by Cherish. Monday edition of the program. Hopefully you all had a great weekend. Weather's supposed to be getting nicer. It'll be summer before we know it. Things are starting to open up, it looks like. We had sports over the weekend. You had golf going on. You had the UFC happening. You had NASCAR happening. So slowly we're getting there. It's all these events with no fans, which is interesting. And quickly, before we're going to get into the Quentin Dunbar story here, Ryan Divish will join us at 3:30, John Clayton at 4 o'clock. We'll speak with ESPN.com's Brady Henderson at 5 o'clock. So a lot of news on Dunbar's situation, his attorney appearing with John Clayton today. We're going to get into all of that. But did you guys take in any of the activities this weekend in terms of sports, watch either golf, the UFC, or NASCAR?
Yeah, I watched a little bit of golf. I didn't get a chance to listen to the golfing show, but I'm sure I would have got a preview there. But I did watch some of that stuff. And, Jim, what is with that dude's swing where he does that little twitch before he swings the club? That was very interesting. I mostly tuned in to watch that guy.
Yeah, Matthew Wolf, an NCAA champion out of Oklahoma State, but yeah, he's got a move there that he triggers his backswing with, and I was just thinking about him though. When you're playing with Ricky Fowler, Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy in this match, and I bet he was a little bit nervous. I know he's been on a big stage before, no fans there.
Yeah, he said he was
carrying your own bags. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you just had to be, because thinking about how many people were watching that, and no, it was a good match though. It went right down to the end, and the course was beautiful. It was fun to see live action. Although, you know, I've been watching the Golf Channel, and they show events from 2017, 2016, and I've forgotten who wins the darn thing, and so I just watch it like it's live. But it was nice to see golf again, and then you know next week. I'm not going to plug the golf show, Dave, because I know you never listen. But we will have a golf show, though, on Saturday at 9 a.m. I guess I just lied.
That sounds like a plug.
It's going to be fun because, yeah, it was. But next week we're going to see Peyton Manning on the golf course and Tom Brady with Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
And
see, I'll watch that.
Phil Mickelson. What,
who's the guy that looked like Leonardo DiCaprio that was out there? Was he golfing?
Is that Ricky Fowler?
Oh, yeah, that was funny. Yeah. Yeah, Ricky Fowler, Dave. You know him, don't you? He always wears orange on Sunday. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I'll watch the football players play golf.
So what did you think of it with no fans? As I said, I've been watching the UFC. This was the third event they had within a week, by the way, all taking place at that arena in Jacksonville. And, by the way, you guys can text in 710-710 to the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Did you guys take in any of these sports? And just wondering if you watch something you otherwise wouldn't watch, but since there's just a select few things actually live, did you take in any of this, whether it's NASCAR, the UFC, or golf? Maybe you otherwise wouldn't watch it. But, Jim, I've kind of become accustomed, I guess, to no fans, you know, being there for this, you know, one of the sports that I love. What did you think of golf with no fans?
It was all right. It was weird to see it, though, and I kept thinking about the players and how they felt about it. The one thing that I bet you that they would love to do once the tour starts again is have the ability to wear shorts. I know it's kind of not a big thing, I guess, when you're thinking about what the event meant yesterday and the money they were raising for COVID-19 relief, but that occurred to me. And I'm sure they just enjoyed being out on the golf course competing again.
Yeah, it was cool. I watched a little bit of the golf, and I saw them interviewing Wolf as they were walking down the fairway, and he talked about being nervous being with those big names and that he started to mellow out after a few holes. But, yeah, it was kind of interesting to watch that. I obviously watched the UFC. I did not watch NASCAR. I did watch some of the cornhole, Jim. I think you'd be proud of me. I watched some of that, which is interesting. I don't quite understand the rules or the you know, some of the strategy going on there, but it's interesting to see those guys in masks and doing their thing, which is all right. It's live.
Don't you just throw a beanbag through a hole?
Yeah, but they'll kind of throw it, like not get it in the hole. They'll sort of surround the hole, I guess, blocking the other guy. And, you know, there's definitely all these different strategies and things. I wasn't that dialed into it to, you know, really pay attention to what they were trying to do. But it was something that was actually happening. So, yeah, that's something I've taken in that I wouldn't otherwise watch. Now, in the future, when we hopefully return to normal, am I going to watch cornhole? Probably not. But for now, I watched it and said, yeah, okay, I can watch this. It's not a sport. It's a competition, not a sport. Yeah. But it was entertaining nonetheless. So if you guys watched something you normally wouldn't watch because it was just on, because you had access to a live event, text it in, 710-710 to the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Well, the Dunbar story continues to unfold. He released a statement on Instagram. And I don't know if you guys saw this, but for the listeners out there that haven't seen it or heard it, on his Instagram account, he said, "I'd like to thank all my fans for the support and apologize to the Seattle Seahawks organization for any unnecessary distractions that these allegations against me may have caused. In addition, I'm very grateful to be part of a team that supports one another and uphold the credibility of each of its members through adverse situations. Moving forward, this entire situation has taught me how to not associate myself with environments that may mischaracterize my values and who I am." Okay. What do you think? Does any of this, I mean, this whole thing, and I know people are going to get upset because if you doubt him, you're convicting him. I said, you know, when we first brought this story up, we said it's innocent till proven guilty. It doesn't look good, but we'll see how this thing plays out. Clearly he was there. Now his lawyer, and we'll go through some of his comments, saying, you know, he's not even really friends with Baker. That relationship's being, you know, sort of misinterpreted, misreported. And, you know, this, how do you look at this? And in the police report, you've got four witnesses saying, yeah, there was Baker there. He did this, that, and the other with the gun. That was Dunbar. Here is what he did. And then those same four within, what is it, 36 hours, do a 180 and say, nope, they weren't involved. How do you look at that and go, yeah, that seems right?
Well, I think you have to treat it like any news that comes out right now. You just can't really tell what's what. You know, I mean, it's amazing how that is such a, like you said, Bob, a 180. The word that keeps coming back to me, though, is one that you like to use, Bob, with the Houston Astros and tipping the pitches, which is?
Complicit.
Complicit. Yeah. So, I mean, if he's there and he's on their side, I mean, and then he didn't either try to stop it, or I guess I just don't see a way out of this, but I think, well, you know, what the attorney is trying to do is, Grieco, he's trying to get everybody to, hey, let's just wait and see what happens. And that's the thing, you know, with social media and all the access that we have to information now, you do end up trying a guy before he, you know, gets a fair trial. So it's just hard to know what to think. But I think, you know, for now, just in general, kind of like the clowny news, I mean, everything is sort of hearsay. What about the, you know, the, and it's not the same type of thing, but this whole rumor about the Browns possibly, you know, being a trade partner for Russell Wilson. I mean, I just think a lot of this stuff you have to take right with a grain of salt right now, because there's just so much information out there and you can't get
a lot done.
Do you do
that even? And, sorry, not yeah, to cut ahead. You off, Dave, but do you treat it the same way when that information's coming directly from the police department? Where you bring up the Browns, which is a good example. That's coming from people saying, well, I've got a source, Chris Sims, Tim Hasselbeck. There's no official statement, if you will. This is a police department saying flat out, hey, we interviewed these guys. We've got them on tape saying X, Y, and Z. So it wasn't, hey, we've heard that there's witnesses, or we've heard. This is, I mean, you have to assume that your law enforcement, I understand they're bad people everywhere in society, including law enforcement. Right. But I think on the surface, don't you think, okay, this is law enforcement saying this. I'm going to take it at face value, at least the report anyway.
Well, the whole thing's goofy and wrong, right? I mean, it's illegal activity, and, you know, you've got a police force. Now, I know people are going to text in, well, it's different down in the South, and, well, maybe it is. But it's just, you know, I feel like I answered a question today, and somebody's like, what do you think about this Dunbar thing? And I'm like, I think at the very least, and this isn't me passing judgment or anything, just having, you know, gotten a whiff of things like this in the past, at the very least, there's going to be a pretty healthy suspension from the NFL. And, you know, and maybe if it's a, you know, case of mistaken identity or something like that, you know, maybe that would, we're all kind of waiting for a Hail Mary here. Like, you really hope that there's a just an outside chance that he wasn't a part of it. But, you know, like you said, when it comes from the police department and you've got affidavits and all that, I mean, it just, it doesn't look good for him. So, but again, I'm trying to sort of, just because, you know, we talked to Les Carpenter, we've talked to so many people that, you know, say I, you know, talked with Bob Condotta over the weekend, you know, it's like there was nobody that had any indication that this was what Quentin Dunbar was all about. And so,
right.
Yeah, it's just, it's really hard to square, but you certainly want to give the guy, you know, a break until it's official and, you know, we actually get, you know, either a conviction or an acquittal.
Yeah, it's, boy, you try and sort through this and make sense of it, and you can't. It just seems like every detail that comes out makes it even more confusing. And, I mean, I just threw out a poll on Twitter on which do you believe, the testimony that was made to police or from the affidavits, and I assume that mostly Seahawk fans responded to the poll because the affidavits won 65% to 35%. But I'm just, you know, I try and look at it objectively. If it wasn't an NFL player, if he didn't play for the Seahawks, if he wasn't a really good player, because I think that skews people's opinions, you know. I mean, if Quentin Dunbar was a guy
Absolutely.
That was just a special teamer or a fringe player, I think people would look at it differently than they would being a guy that might dramatically improve that Seahawk defense. So, in other words, I'd be a poor choice for the jury if they were looking to do jury selection down in Florida, to be honest with you, because I have a hard time looking at this going, okay, let's see, four people said this to the police, and then those same four people said something completely opposite the next day in the affidavits. I don't know. You know, the good news for Quentin Dunbar, whether he did anything or not, it looks like if it's a he said, she said, that the prosecutor won't be able to bring charges and won't be able to have a case. So whether he did it or not, he's probably going to get off. So, I know I say I don't know a lot, but boy, on this one, I really don't know.
None of us do.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, you just look at it and you go, really? All these different things? You know, Dave, I hope you're right about, I hope you're not right about that NFL suspension. I don't know how they can suspend him if he's exonerated. And I know that you'll probably say, let me speak for you here for a second, Dave. I know you're probably going to come back and say, well, there have been times where a guy hasn't been found guilty, but because of the
Ben
personal conduct policy, there's still going to be.
Yeah,
okay. But do you think that will apply in this? If all of a sudden they come out and find, you know, the police department says, you know what, it was mistaken identity, we were wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's still a chance.
Well, if he wasn't there. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it could have been that he wasn't even there, but I guess...
No, his attorney's already said he was there.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's... That, and like Bob likes to say, complicit. I mean, you're part of it. You're there. So I feel like that would at least be a misconduct thing. I was going to ask you, Jim, would you feel this same way if it was Clowney? Because you said that Dunbar can really help this defense, and you don't think that Clowney can. So would there be a difference in your opinion?
You know, Dave, I think I might just have to go with Touche on that one.
Hey, well, let's get to some of the cuts of his attorney. His attorney, Michael Grieco, was on with John Clayton today. Cut number one. For those of you that haven't heard this yet, cut number one, he's talking about the five witnesses now say the allegations against Dunbar aren't accurate.
With these five individuals, you know, one of them had always consistently said that what the other four said was not accurate. So he gave the same statement to the police as the same statement he gave me. But the other four individuals, they've come around and they're telling the truth now, and they told it to myself that this didn't happen. And, you know, we're hoping that the state attorney's office down here does the right thing.
Well, I sure hope he's right, just because, you know, look, if these guys went that far and change that much, you know, then it seemed like they're really trying to, you know, get him out of trouble here. And I guess I'm like, well, why would they do that? Because, and this is just all speculation, because again, we're not, taking all of this as if it were, you know, the word of God. We're just, you know, kind of trying to speculate, how does this happen? How does it go from that to this all of a sudden? And it just seems like, well, if you got robbed and, you know, you're going to be pretty pissed off and you're probably not going to be that likely to help somebody who was, you know, in some way part of it. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, what did he do? Did he maybe stay in the car, you know, and not come in, or was he trying to settle things down? I mean, I have no idea what possible scenario. I think everybody's run through these things, and it's, you know, probably not fair to the process of justice for sure. So, but, you know, since we're sitting here speculating on it, I'm just hoping that, again, I'm just hoping that, you know, I want what's just, right? I mean, I don't want Quentin Dunbar to get away with something if he was wrong in doing it or anything. I just hope, my hope is that somehow, like I said, a Hail Mary is that he just was mistaken identity, or he wasn't part of it, or he was trying to calm the situation down. But still, I think just even if he's there, I mean, that's still going to be a problem for the NFL.
Well, I'd like to know who the one person is, and maybe they've said who it is, and I've just lost track of it. But if that one person is someone who wasn't Dunbar's friend, then I think it holds a lot more water, what he had to say. The one person I'm talking about is the, you know, that went opposite the other four, and he's been consistent with what he said all along, saying that what the other four were saying wasn't accurate. But if it's his buddy, if it's his childhood buddy, then I'm throwing that out. I suppose I would consider it, but I would also consider that, well, okay, you're Dunbar's buddy here. I'm not so sure how much I'm going to put into that. One thing I will say, and since we're just jumping to conclusions and bouncing all over the place here, that would help, at least for me, it would partially explain him doing that Zoom call with reporters the next day with such ease the way he did. So if you're Dunbar and you left that party and you had nothing to do with it, then that would help for me anyway, explain that he could hang out with reporters and talk to him about what he was going to mean to the Seahawks.
Yeah, I don't. Sorry, guys, I dropped there for a sec. So I'm not sure if you did. You play another cut or just the one so far?
No, we didn't. I'd like to hear. Right. Well, I won't call the shots, but there's some interesting ones here.
Go ahead, Dave. Which one do you want to hear?
I'll call him if you want. You want me to call him?
Cut. Well, Jim, you've already done that in the past. So let me give it a shot here, because I really want to hear cut number four here.
I'm not going to speak to the type of people. I get the impression that these guys are scam artists, but I can't, beyond that, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. I can just tell you that, you know, if you're going to, you know, some Airbnb out of county, you know, it is what it is. You know, unfortunately, if you're around anybody that you don't know, and you don't know well, you're setting yourself up for things.
All right, so there's cut number four. He's talking, the title of that cut is Grieco Believes the Witnesses in This Case Are Scam Artists. Well, aren't they the ones that are, I'm assuming he's talking about whoever maintains that his client is guilty, because the other four have had a complete about face, so I don't think calling them scam artists would help his case at all. So I'll assume he's talking about somebody that's speaking out against Dunbar, saying, yeah, the witnesses that are supporting him, those are solid citizens. Those other people, those are scam artists.
Well, and it was interesting how in the beginning he's like, well, I don't want to, you know, taint anybody's character or anything, and then calls them scam artists. So that was confusing to me.
Yeah. Well, and then also saying, you know, the other four individuals have come around and they're telling the truth now. And when you see that, you kind of go, well, what made them come around? Was there any fishy things going on behind the scenes that we should know about? So I mean, so many things don't add up, but based on what we know right now, if you had to guess with the he said, she said going on, boy, it looks better and better for Dunbar as the days go by.
Yeah, I would just love to hear the police speak to these witnesses again, you know, if they get revised statements or however the process works. And they say, hey, you know, hey, Jim Moore, you told me on this day that you here are your words. It was Quentin Dunbar. It was DeAndre Baker. He said this. He had a gun. He did this. He grabbed the wallet. And now you've completely flipped around and said, no, it wasn't them. They didn't do anything. Tell me how that works. How does that work with the witness? I mean, are they in any kind of potential danger of perjury, or is that only in a court of law? I don't. It just seems awfully weird to have a complete 180, not a variation in story where they were a little fuzzy on a detail and then okay, now I remember. I mean, you're getting a complete opposite story from the same people. So that just, even if you want Dunbar to be innocent in the worst way, you got to look at that and go, boy, that doesn't fly very well. And it may screw up the case and maybe nothing happens out of this, but it just, you see that on the surface and go, wait, the same person who said, yep, It was him. He said this. He did that. Then 36 hours later goes, yeah, no, wasn't them. They had nothing to do with it. How do you not look at that and go, come on, man. What's going on here?
I think any further comment from me would only further confuse the listeners.
Okay. Well, you want to play one more or do you want to go into take two? Your call. Dave, you're running the show. Two. You go ahead. All right. Let's take two.
Okay.
It's time to take two. Brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
Take two.
Earlier today, Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced that professional sports can resume without fans May 31st in Texas, and California Governor Gavin Newsom announced the same with June 1st as their target date.
I like it. I'm going to assume all of these people have done their due diligence and they have a plan in place. And yeah, there won't be fans there. Which, again, I think provides a really unique opportunity for some fans watching on TV that haven't seen the UFC or, you know, had a chance to see some of these things and, more importantly, hear things that you otherwise wouldn't hear without a crowd there. So I think it could be pretty cool, and I'm hoping these other sports don't follow Fox's lead and try to pipe in crowd noise and, you know, put in virtual fans in the background or whatever. Let it be. I think people will appreciate it in its raw form.
Well, I'm chuckling right now because I was thinking of Adam Ray's Twitter where he was going to be the fans and he was doing
was
all
good,
the comments that you could. If you could, go check that out and you'll get a good laugh. But how about this, Jim? The biggest upset maybe in this whole thing, the Texas governor and the California governor with the same thought. That's amazing.
Yeah, agreeing on getting sports back in their states. And no, I'm with you, though, Bob and Dave. I look at this and I'm going, okay, well, that's a step in the right direction, and yeah, you're right, Bob. If all the health precautions are in place, and also I don't want to see that piped in noise. I just can't believe they're doing that. Just, I mean, use this as a time to get more creative with miking up players and doing different things that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise with the fans there.
NFL Network's Tom Pelissero reports that the NFL is immediately instituting changes to the Rooney Rule, requiring clubs interview at least two external minority candidates for two head coaching openings and one minority candidate for any coordinator job. That's on top of two resolutions up for vote in a virtual owners meeting tomorrow.
Yeah, we saw the story that came out last week that there was an idea put out there. I guess it came from the owners and not the league, that they wanted to provide some sort of incentive for teams to do this and improve their draft position. In the third round, you could move up by X amount of spots if you hire a GM and X amount of spots if you hire a minority head coach, which I thought was interesting. I mean, it's sort of sad you have to be incentivized to do this. To me, it's unfortunate. You've got, I think, four minority head coaches in the league at this point. Yeah, I don't know if there are qualified candidates out there that aren't getting opportunities. I'm not going to pretend to know everybody who's up for a job or trying to interview. So I don't know if brilliant minds are being passed over. It seems like any team at this point in time would be looking at who is going to get me to the promised land. Which guy gives me the best shot at holding that trophy? I don't care if he's 8 feet tall and he's painted green. He's got one arm and one. I don't care if he's that mind. That's the guy I want. I'm not saying racism doesn't exist. I'm not an idiot. But the fact that an owner would go out of his way to say, yeah, he fits, but he's a minority. I'd rather have a Caucasian. It just, winning's too important. Well, the most important color is green. And winning equals green.
Yeah. Well, I always assume that that's the case anyway. But again, I don't want to be naive. But yeah, this did not go over well. And this morning on NFL Network, Steve Wyche and Jim Trotter, who are both African-American reporters for the NFL, they said this did not go over well at all because, you know, they used the phrase scarlet letter, like, oh, you know, I only got hired because you were rewarded with a draft choice. That's not the way I want to get my job. So, you know, right. The interview part of it, though, is extended. So, you know, that's the way to do it, not this other way, because it just didn't go over well with African-American coaches as well. So, yeah, it's just I think it's they're trying to do the right thing, but it just didn't come off the right way. So, yeah, I thought it was interesting, and Jim Trotter did a great job because he said he had talked to 10, 12 different coaches, you know, whether it's offensive coordinators, quarterbacks, quarterback coaches, you know, head coaches, and, you know, all of them were pretty firmly against the draft choice thing. But certainly for, you know, extending, you know, the whole Rooney Rule a little bit more, just, you know, at least hire guys. And the thing is, you know, I think everybody's trying to get the best coach, and a lot of people will say, well, there's nepotism too. Well, if you go look at the nepotism, I mean, that would take out Kyle Shanahan, that would take out Wade Phillips. You know, there's a lot of, you know, coaches' sons that are coaching. Marvin Lewis has a son, and so does Anthony Lynn, a son who coaches in the league. So, you know, it just, I think everybody's trying to win, but, you know, if you just make it, okay, you at least interview, you know, and try to find some of these minority, you know, candidates for head coach and those kinds of jobs, I think, you know, that's going to make it better. But the other way was, like I said, it went over like a lead balloon. Nobody liked it. And that included, you know, guys like Tony Dungy and Mike Tomlin.
Well, yeah, when you look at it right now, Mike Tomlin, Anthony Lynn, Ron Rivera, and Brian Flores, the only minority head coaches in the NFL, and Flores was the only minority who was hired last year, and there were 8 different openings. And also reading a story that as of last year, no African-American team presidents in the NFL. So clearly they're heading in the wrong direction and need to get going back in the right direction.
All right, coming up, we get Ryan Divish's opinion on the 67-page document regulating the Major League Baseball's precautions for resuming play during the pandemic. I'm sure he's read every word of it, and we'll get his take on it next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Coming up, Dave Wyman will give us a little preview of a couple more players, a couple more rookie free agents for your Seattle Seahawks. That's in less than 15 minutes, but right now we talk baseball because there's a 67-page document regulating Major League Baseball's precautions for resuming play, and we know that our guest right here on the hotline with us has read every single word of it. He covers the Mariners for the Seattle Times. He is my buddy Ryan Divish. How are you, man? Was it exhilarating? Was it a page-turner? How'd you feel about those 67 pages?
I mean, it's like one of those old go-to guy columns in the PI, you know, I'd read those and you find yourself just trying to fight your way through it like it was War and Peace or, you know, East of Eden or one of those novels that were, 500 pages and, you know, the my favorite part in the old go-to guy columns is he'd write 3 paragraphs and go, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong on this, but this is just my thought. So, no, I have.
Hey, come on, they were never 67 pages long, Ryan.
No, but you could fill up that inside part of the page a lot, you know. I mean, it was funny, we were talking about this, me and some of the other writers, like some of the stuff we used to write about now, you never write about anymore. I mean, you wrote a whole column about how your wife thought Nicole Zalumis was hot. I mean, it's like, what the heck is going on here? So these are different times, that's for certain. But, all the Husky hate you would throw out there. There was always, I always enjoyed it because I thought it was different. And so I shouldn't say that. I work for the Times and talking nice about the PI. I think Frank Weston might punch me in the head. So. No, I have not read all 67 pages. I've read the Cliff Notes version provided by Jeff Passan and Joel Sherman and the other guys. I have really horrible ADD, and even with the Adderall that I'm on, I couldn't make it through 67 pages of that.
Well, let me. Unless you want to keep talking about Jim Moore's columns, I was going to ask you about like anything that stood out, either positive or negative. What were? I'm sure that you have more to gripe about than to praise. So let's just keep it to that. What's wrong with it? What were some of the things that stood out to you?
I didn't see that there's anything wrong with it. I was stunned though. Like the note. I mean, I knew that was part of it because they're doing it in the KBO. But you know, in the Asian cultures, they don't spit in the dugout. And they don't spit sunflower seeds in the dugout. Like baseball dugouts are disgusting. Baseball players in general are pretty gross. Not as gross as a hockey locker room, which is the single most disgusting thing I've ever been a part. It reeks. It reeks so bad in a hockey locker room. Like those pads, they're like a science experiment. But football locker rooms are pretty gross post game, like especially the visitors one, because it's so just, you know, it's so confined in there and it's just not, you know, it's just uncomfortable being around huge human beings are trying to get undressed and there's like no room. Or people like Porkchop Womack, who love to just sit at his locker in his jock and nothing else to talk to the media, which I mean, the amount of stretch marks on that man's body was terrifying. But baseball players in general are pretty gross. The spitting, the tobacco, you know, the dipping, seeds, you know, they have a habit like in the dugout, they'll take a drink of water out of the cup and just throw the cup on the ground, stuff like that. I remember Ichiro always complained about how big a slob baseball players are. And, you know, so that aspect, I was like, well, that's going to be a huge change. You know, just all the little things that baseball players are so accustomed to doing. Like I think that they're going to have problems with that, you know, and then the testing and some of the stuff like asking them to be in the hotel at all times on the road. Well, you know, it was a lot different even when I first started covering where guys would go out and have beers and stuff like that. You know, a lot of these guys now are a lot more nerdy. They just sit in their rooms and play PlayStation or sleep, you know, but still a lot of them like to go out to dinner and stuff like that. So all that stuff is kind of, they're asking them to change everything about them. I think that's the biggest difference. The rest, it's all totally adaptable. You know, I think all the stuff that they're asking and they want to do, they're concessions that have to be made. But I don't think that you're asking for a ton because you're asking normal everyday people to wear a mask and to stay 6 feet apart in stores and go down aisles in a certain direction, which I still have not figured out. But all these things that they're asking the everyday public to do, I don't think it's too much of an ask to ask baseball players to do it either.
All right. I probably should ask you some profound question about the state of the game and whether you think it's going to happen this summer and all that. But it just occurred to me, which Mariner player is going to have the hardest time stopping spitting?
Oh, that's a good question, Jim. I'm trying to think who dips the most on the team and spits a lot. Vogelbach usually has a dip in quite a bit. I'm trying to think who else. You know, a lot of those guys don't chew, which is strange. I think there's a couple pitchers that'll be bad, but yeah, I think some of the coaches might have a problem more than some of the players because technically they're not supposed to do it anyways, based on like the King County rules and stuff. I don't think they're supposed to dip in the dugout. They all do. I mean, they all break those rules, but. Yeah, I don't know, but maybe Vogelbach, you know. You remember some of those guys? Well, look, I'll say this. When I was in school, when I was in college, you weren't supposed to play in college with it, but we would take beech nut, and then we'd take Big League Chew and wrap a ball of beech nut around a big wad of Big League Chew and just chew brown gum. And the front of my catcher's mask had just like a stain of brown from me spitting on that. So I've quit chewing since, but yeah. I mean, I don't know. They can do it. I mean, if you ask them, they can do it. My guess is they'll be really good about doing it for a few weeks and then break the rules anyways because that's what players do. And, I mean, how we're seeing that around here. Like, following guidelines, everywhere was gung-ho about quarantining and sheltering in place for about a month. And then after that, it got nice. Everybody was like, screw this. I'm not doing this anymore.
Hey, Ryan, we're up against the break. So give me in 15 seconds whether you think they're going to come to an agreement on the finances. That seems to be the sticking point. 50-50 split versus a prorated portion of their salary. We've heard they're going to lose, $640,000 per game played if they do their prorated salary. So do you expect that they're going to find a financial agreement?
Yeah, I do. I think there'll be some sort of concessions made, and because they know the look would be bad, and there's too much money at stake. Even if they think there's losses, there's way too much at stake not to have these games. So, yeah, I think they will get an agreement. I think that the MLB offered a hardline agreement. I think they'll adjust. I think the players will adjust, because always your first agreement is you always say no to everything first, and then you adjust from there. So I think they will get something done.
Good stuff, Ryan. We always appreciate it. Stay safe out there. Keep that social distancing, which you've been doing your whole life, in place. It's very natural for you. So we appreciate that about you. We'll talk to you next week, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to go read some Jim Moore columns in my free time now.
Perfect. Perfect. Support the go-to guy. We appreciate it, Ryan.
See you guys.
All right, good stuff from Ryan Divish. Coming up, Dave Wyman has moved into the undrafted free agents portion of our Seahawks rookie profiles. Today he's got some cornerbacks for us. So see what Dave saw. He's going to tell us all about it next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
A reminder, you've got radios in your homes, whether you know it or not. If you've got a smart speaker, Google, Alexa, whatever it is, just tell it to play 710 ESPN Seattle or 710 AM, and boom, you got us right there. Coming up at the top of the hour, the professor, John Clayton, will join us, talk some football. But Dave Wyman has been parked in front of a video screen, hitting rewind, pause, breaking down every single Seahawks draft pick from this season. He's gone through all of them, and now he's making his way through the undrafted free agents, and you've looked at a couple more for us, Dave.
Yeah, it's a little harder to find stuff on some of these undrafted free agents, but they actually have 11 cornerbacks, if they're counting Jason Stanley as a corner. He's just listed as a defensive back, but without him, yeah. And then, you know, there's guys like Nico Thorpe, of course, from last year, and then Shaq and Trey, and then Quentin Dunbar, which we talked about already. But then there's some, you know, some guys like Brian Allen, who's a third-year guy out of Utah. You're looking at Ryan Neal, a kid from Southern Illinois who's had one-year experience. Lyndon Stevens, one-year guy from Cincinnati. And then the Stanley kid I mentioned, a one-year guy out of Georgia. But I went ahead and looked at the free agents. And again, there's not a lot to – the rookie free agents, not a lot to find. And some of these guys don't have a lot of stats. They're just kind of going off of what they've seen on you know, and talking to them and things like that. And I think both – so the guys I'm going to look at, Kima Siverand, who's Oklahoma State. Hopefully I'm saying his name right. He's 6 foot, 205 pounds. The other guy is Debion Renfro, who's a corner out of Texas A&M, 6'2", 198, which that really fits their profile there. And then the other one is Gavin Heslop from Stony Brook, 6 foot, 197. And I texted Jessamyn McIntyre because her dad, Bobby McIntyre, is the D coordinator there. So she had a couple of you know, things that she asked her dad about that we'll get into. But look at Kima Siverand first, 6 foot, 205, Oklahoma State. He was a wide receiver at A&M, and then he transferred to Oklahoma State. And so, you know, he played in the SEC and the Big 12. But this is the guy that probably there's just not a lot of on him. He played in 13 games, 17 tackles, and one fumble recovery. That's his college line stat. So there's just not a lot there. The one thing I did find was that he had one of those just highlight film knockout hits. And I'm not sure – it did not get flagged, and I'm not sure if it would get flagged in the NFL. But basically he was sitting out in the flat, and a receiver came out. And I don't know, the receiver – there used to be an old – adage that says you don't run through a zone, you sit down in a zone. You run away from man, because if you run through zones, you're going to get stoned, and that's what happened. So, but, you know, he's just a big hitter, delivered a huge hit there. But, you know, I mean, it looks like he's a great kid. I saw a couple interviews of him, and they think he's a leader. I guess he gave some big pep talk at one point, and everybody stood up and listened. So that's Kima Siverand out of Oklahoma State. The kid from A&M, Debion Renfro, that, like I said, he's really the guy that looks the most. He looks the part. He's 6'2", 200 pounds. And he's had 123 tackles, 2.5 sacks, 14 passes defensed, 6.5 tackles for loss, 3 forced fumbles, 1 fumble recovery. Problem is, zero interceptions. So, you know, I mean, that's – I always look for production. But, you know, he did play in the SEC at Texas A&M, and against LSU, he had six tackles and a pass broken up. He uses his offhand really well is one thing. You know, when you look at defensive backs, sometimes they'll – or linebackers, they'll reach with the wrong hand. You're supposed to reach with the long one, the long arm, which means, you know, you use your back and the arm. It'll get you an extra – well, the width of your back, basically. So, and he does a good side with it, or a good job with his onside hand as far as not grabbing guys. So, saw a little bit out of that. The guy with the most production, though, that I was, you know, you're talking about they're playing the Colonial League, but the kid from Stony Brook, Gavin Heslop, 6 foot, 197 pounds. He's from Yonkers, New York. And, you know, if you don't know the Colonial League, it's like, first of all, they played Utah State. So that was probably their biggest opponent. But they played Wagner, Fordham, Rhode Island. I mean, those kinds of schools. But he had 37 straight starts, including 12 his senior year. And he's really an aggressive tackler. And you want to talk about production. This kid really just lots of – one of the things is he had close to 20 tackles for loss. I swear 15 or 16 of them must have been on that little fire screen, you know, where you have – two wide receivers to one side, or maybe three sometimes, and one guy will step back, and the other two will go block the DB. It just, I mean, I didn't see every single play, obviously, but it just looked like he's unblockable by wide receivers. Really, really fast, really good, but just to kind of go through his stats, all the production, his sophomore year, he blocked a punt that got returned for a touchdown, and he had 72 tackles, 8.5 tackles for loss, and a sack. And then his junior year, he had 59 tackles, 4 tackles for loss, a sack, a fumble recovery for 87-yard touchdown. And then his last year in the league, or I'm sorry, his senior year, 52 tackles, 8.5 tackles for loss, a sack and a half, 2 blocked kicks. You know, so that always is anybody that knows how to block kicks coming. I didn't know how to block a damn kick when I came out of college. And, you know, when I was in high school, I remember diving for the ball when the punter, you know, rushing the punter. And yeah, you're supposed to
you're
just
not
go
supposed
up and
to
take
do
the
that?
Ball right off the no, you're not supposed to dive over the top of the ball. Yeah, so yeah, but I did it. I just like didn't even look. I just came free and would just jump in the air. But you're supposed to just take it right off the guy's foot. And so he has a little bit of experience that, so that's good for special teams. He had 3 forced fumbles his senior year, and then 1 fumble recovery, another one for a touchdown. So he had 2 touchdowns while he was at Stony Brook. But, yeah, Jess told me that he's a true corner, that's what her dad said, and that he, you know, is much more of an outside guy than an inside guy. Really liked him. Thought he was a good kid, really nice kid, and he's somebody who wouldn't probably be a nickel guy. He's like more of a true corner. But she said he's, you know, really long, fits the prototype the Seahawks like. So, and I didn't get a chance to see how long his arms are because he didn't go to the combine. And so, you know, it's kind of hard to find information on these guys. But yeah, that kid was the most productive and looked really good. So keep your eye on these guys. And hopefully I'm saying their names right. Kima Sivarand, Debion Renfro, and then Gavin Heslop out of Stony Brook.
Well, if they make the roster, we'll learn how to say those names correctly without question.
Yes,
good stuff. Dave Wyman doing a great job just parking himself in front of a monitor and breaking down all of these guys who are going to be trying to fulfill a dream of making the Seahawks roster. A reminder, we've got another edition of Mariners Classic tonight at 7 p.m. It's Felix Hernandez's shutout of the Red Sox in 2012. So tune in for that one. It's brought to you by Roofers and Waterproofers Local 54. Coming up, we'll ask the professor what to expect from the NFL virtual owners meeting tomorrow. That's coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.